Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm, you know, what an impressive group of historians that you all are. So it's a lot easier to talk to non-historians because I know more about Civil War than they do, but I don't know more about Civil War than you guys. So, but thank you for having me. What I wrote is kind of a hybrid book. So it's part history and part leadership. And I realized early on, I didn't even consider the fact that I could write, you know, a definitive history of a battle. People, you know, they spend their whole lives working to become that level of historian. What I did was I looked at day in the life stories, and I drew primarily from primary sources, letters, memoirs, things that were written at the time by the people that were there, and then connected those day in the life stories to some modern research going on in the field of leadership and how organizations work and how people think, and we'll dive into that in just a moment. Before though we get into the book, I'd like to tell you guys about one project. You know, we have a lot of Civil War sites under the Regional Park Authority, but one that is I'm hoping that we can get, and I'd love for your help, is just west of Loudoun County is Clark County, just over the mountain on the other side. And in 1864, there was the Battle of Cool Spring as Jubal Early was leaving from attacking Washington, and the forces, Union forces in Washington, were in hot pursuit. He set up defenses at the Shenandoah River and fought a pitched battle there. Well, there currently isn't any sort of Civil War site at that location. We've been working with the Civil War Trust. They have an option to buy what is currently the Virginia National Golf Club, which is a 200-acre golf course right on the Shenandoah River, and it's right in the core area of the battle. The battle took place on both sides of the river. They're also working with the Holy Cross Monastery, which is on the west side of the river, to get a conservation easement. They want to give to the Regional Park Authority that 200 acres to create a battlefield park. And the golf course has gone bankrupt numerous times. And it's in the floodplain. It floods all the time. It wasn't a great idea probably to build the golf course right there. We would try to transform that site, make it look like it did in 1864, have volunteers out there leading tours on the weekend, make it a, you know, a great Civil War site. In order for that all this to happen, Clark County needs to join the Regional Park Authority, because under law we're not allowed to own property in a jurisdiction that hasn't joined. We have a modest per capita rate that every jurisdiction that's a member of the Regional Park Authority, we have three counties and three cities currently, has to pay. It only covers a small part of our operating costs, and for Clark County it would be $65,000 a year that would cover both operating and capital. We're going to invest a lot more than that in there. So really, they're getting the Civil War Trust is buying the land. We're going to transform it and operate it, which will cost a lot more than that. It's a bargain for Clark County, but there are neighbors that don't want there to be a public park in this place. They're concerned about all the rabble that'll come out there, and you know, we keep telling them that Civil War enthusiasts are great people. Are people coming out there to learn about the battle, and the site will be fantastic. The thing that you could do for us is, if you'd like to see a new Civil War battlefield, how often do we get a chance to do that? Is if you could write to the Board of Supervisors of Clark County, and just don't tell them I told you to write, but just express to them that you are interested in a new battlefield park, that Civil War enthusiasts are good people, that it would be a wonderful educational opportunity, and it would be a great economic development opportunity, because tourism is the number two industry in Virginia, and Civil War drives a heck of a lot of the tourism. We don't think about it, particularly folks that are most interested in the history. But we're traveling around to sites, spending money, and that is it's a big economic part of Virginia. So that's my non lead like a general plea, if you will. So let's talk about the book a little bit. I love this map. This was, you all may be familiar with this. This was done by one of the railroad companies right after the war. And each red dot is a Civil War action. It's a skirmish, a battle. And, you know, it's a bit interesting because, you know, even as historians, you think about the big battles. You know, First Manassas, Second Manassas, there was the Battle of Ox Hill. That's about it. You know, move on. Heck no, there was action going on all over this area. Really, when you look at it, Northern Virginia was the front line and center stage for the Civil War. Civil War happened in, you know, 10,000 places all over North America, all over the world. There were conflicts going on, but this was the front, the center stage. The Eastern Theater was really where it's at politically. We were, you know, there's 100 miles between Washington and Richmond, and the fighting took place right here. So, and as it turns out, many of those sites are regional parks. Not all of them, but many of them are. I tried to highlight many of the regional parks just because I love our regional parks. But I also tried to draw sort of day-in-the-life stories from lesser-known actions in many cases. I cover some big battles, but lots of them are not necessarily the biggest. So, oh, and by the way, this is not PowerPoint. This is a software called Prezi, which kind of zips around. Well, buckle up, because we're going to be zipping around. So I'm just going to read parts of this, and other parts we'll just fly through. But this is chapter one, The Power of Momentum, John Mosby. And it happened very near this very location. So their hearts pounded with adrenaline. Their horses panted from a long day of riding and nearly 2 miles of being chased by the enemy. The group of nearly 50 Confederate cavalry waited silently behind some fallen trees on the side of the road, while 200 Union cavalry raced towards them. It was a cold, wet day in late March with less than 2 hours of sunlight left. Many of the Confederates had not known each other long. Some had just met that day. They'd come from every possible background. Two English soldiers of fortune, one a decorated veteran of the Crimean War, one a 50-year-old blacksmith recently turned soldier. Some grew up in the area, and some from other units who signed up with the group for the day to see if they could win a horse. Not exactly the crack force you'd want while going up against a force four times as large. As if those odds were not bad enough, they were on the edge of a massive Union encampment surrounding the city of Washington. Thousands of Union soldiers within the radius of a few miles and no sizable Confederate force nearby. Yet the group was supremely confident in their ultimate victory. They had actually picked this fight, essentially waking a sleeping giant. This small band had earlier attacked the guards of a large Union cavalry base in Chantilly, Virginia, 30 miles from the nation's capital. The Confederates then retreated, chased by four times the number of Union horsemen spread out for nearly a mile along the one-lane road, while the Southerners stayed in a tight group just out of range of the Union force. So we're in that moment. We're behind those trees. What happened next was classic Mosby and brilliant. He had known that the way that the Union would react, that if he attacked them, he went up to the guards and, you know, attacked and ran away, that they wouldn't think about it, they wouldn't plan, they wouldn't have much of a command structure, they just react. And the way they reacted was, you know, every soldier who could jump on a horse started running after him. And he also knew that if he allowed them to chase him long enough along the one-lane country road that was Route 50, that human nature the way it is, they'd spread out. So they were basically single file, more or less, for a mile. So really, it wasn't 200 Union force in a tight, well-organized group. They were in a long line. So when the the front edge of that line came up over the hill. And, you know, we've got these rolling hills. So they were just over the edge of one of these hills. The Confederates attacked from the side. And the Union, you know, the first Union horsemen that came over the hill, they thought, surely this can't be the same group that we were just chasing. It's an ambush. It's a trap. There must be a huge force here, or they wouldn't be attacking us unless they had more forces than we had. So the leading edge spins around, starts heading back in terror, and what happens? You hear the shots, you see the folks riding in the other direction, it's a trap. The entire line fell like a line of dominoes, and they all turned and ran. And after the battle, I think there were 3 Union casualties, no Confederate casualties. The Confederates, the Mosby's group, captured, I forget, 30 or 50 horses, a lot of gear, and went on their way. And, of course, the Union went back and wrote their reports that it was an overwhelming force, and, you know, they're not sure what hit them, but it was big. But it was a classic Mosby strategy. That's there he is right there. So this is March of 1863. This is very early in his command around here. And this was actually the quote that got me going on this book, because when I read this quote, I thought, wow, I've been reading a lot of leadership stuff. This fits perfectly. And I bet if this fits perfectly, there's a Civil War story for every leadership principle out there. So what Mosby wrote after that engagement was that my success had been so interrupted that the men thought victory was chained to my standard. Men going into a fight under the influence of such feelings are next to invincible and victors before it begins. That's a really powerful statement about the power of your expectations, the power of perception. You know, they thought he could do no wrong. So when he was leading them, I mean, another group, you know, being chased by 4 times the number and no reinforcement nearby, and they're tired and it's a long day, they might have been terrified. These guys went into it just with supreme confidence that they were going to win. And because of that, they did. So here's some of the modern research that supports this. The MIT has been doing a study of executives, and they found that executives that project confidence and optimism non-verbally were 87% more effective than the executives that did not have a positive, energetic mannerism. And that's a 2008 MIT study. There he is right there in the middle, and there's his confident group. The Gallup Research Organization that does polling and has done polling for years, they have a number of books that they've put out on leadership that all draw from the same body of knowledge. And one of the things that they found was that employees were 69% more engaged in their jobs when their leaders were enthusiastic about the future, and only 1% engaged in their jobs when their leaders did not inspire hope. That's pretty big. So if you have a group and you're moping around saying, oh my gosh, the sky's falling, you're not going to be able to accomplish very much. Clearly, Mosby was able to use that momentum to great effect. And if you think about what he did, you know, he started with very small actions, surprise attack here, surprise attack there. By the end of the war, he had 1,000 soldiers and was doing a lot more. But he didn't start that way. He started with, you know, 20, 30 guys at a time. He never quite knew how many he'd have when he'd call them together. And he started by picking his fights and building a chain of successes. Now, you all probably know he didn't win every battle, but he won a lot, enough that he really created a tremendous amount of momentum and enthusiasm. One of the things that I also put in my book quite a bit is Sun Tzu's Art of War. And I don't know if how familiar you are with it, but it is really an amazing source of insights about people and organizations and how they work. So, and Sun Tzu wrote 500 BC in China. So if you can connect 500 BC in China with the Civil War, with modern research on business leaders, the interesting thing is technology changes, but people really don't. We are the same. We've been the same. We will be the same. So Sun Tzu wrote that you fight with momentum. There are only a few types of surprise and direct action, yet you can always vary the ones you use. There's no limit to the ways you can win. Surprise and direct action give birth to one another. They're like a circle without an end. You cannot exhaust all the possible combinations. Sun Tzu. So there's a positive example of leadership. Chapter 2, not quite as positive. But also at a location of a great regional park, the Aldi Mill. So this takes place at the Battle of Aldi. It's about George Armstrong Custer. So we all know about Custer's last stand. That everyone knows about that. 1876, Battle of Little Bighorn. Custer leads his group charge. They're all massacred. Well, Custer had a long history in the Civil War of doing very much the same sort of thing, but with reinforcements behind him. So in June of 1863, a 23-year-old Captain Custer shows up in the little town of Aldi. Now, I'm not going to read all this. I'll just tell you about it. The Battle of Aldi, there were 2,000 Union cavalry, 2,000 Confederate cavalry, and some infantry thrown in there, too. A small town of Aldi, and it was in July. You know how hot it is. There probably wasn't any breeze. And they were fighting pretty much all day with their black powder. You can only imagine the heat, the smoke, the chaos of that kind of battle. And Custer shows up kind of in the afternoon, and he's given a command of a group of Maine cavalry. And the big problem at Aldi was, let me zip over here, was over here, Snickersville Turnpike. Right up here, there was a stone wall, and there were Confederate sharpshooters up there that were just a force that the Union could not overcome. So it was pretty even battle for the most part, but these sharpshooters that were behind the wall were kind of unbeatable. So Custer gets his group, and what does he do? He just charges straight at them, and he overcomes the sharpshooters behind the stone wall at a huge cost. I mean, I think he had 300 cavalry under his command, and close to 200 of them were lost by the end of the day. I mean, it wasn't good duty to be under the command of Custer. He actually overran his own troops and went right into the Confederate lines. And he wrote a letter to his sister afterwards, and he credited his large, wide-brimmed hat as saving his life, because the smoke was so thick that his hat was similar to most the ones most of the Confederates were wearing. He was able to turn around and fight his way back into the Union line. The interesting thing is, at the end of the battle, there was a New York newspaper reporter embedded with the Union troops, and they were desperate for a victory. Morale was pretty low at the Union at that point. And so this reporter wrote about the tremendous heroism of Captain Custer and how Captain Custer, you know, led the charge numerous times and was just fantastic. Within 3 weeks of that newspaper article coming out, Captain Custer becomes Brigadier General Custer at age 23 and is the youngest general in U.S. history, and goes on. And if it weren't for the Battle of Aldi, no one would have ever heard of Custer, because he was a captain, and he probably never would have become a general if it had not been for the actions of that day and the fact that there was a reporter and the fact that there was a need to elevate a hero. So that's the story of Custer. There he is. He was very flamboyant. He had his own suits made with velvet and lots of gold piping. There's a little bit of the battle. And here's the modern research. It's very interesting. There was some research done out of Duke University. And what they found was that when people make decisions under great emotional stress, it kind of creates a path in their mind. And once that path is there, they tend to fall into that path time and time and time again, irrespective of what the new conditions are. So what they would, a little bit more about the experiment, they had two groups. One they exposed to the most violent, emotionally wrenching movies and TV shows they can come up with. Just, you know, just horrible stuff. And the other group was watching just benign, friendly stuff. And then they gave them a test. They said, okay, here's the test. I have $20. And if you're willing to take $5, I'm going to keep $15. And we both get something. And if you don't take $5, then neither of us get anything. What would you like to do? Well, the group that had been exposed to all of the negative imagery for a couple of hours, they said, basically, expletive you, you're not getting more than me. Pox on our house. I'm not going to do a deal with you. That's terrible. You're getting more than me. I'm not going for that. Well, it's not a really rational decision. I mean, the rational decision is you get nothing or you get something. Why not get something? The people that had been in the benign, pleasant environment, they said, well, that's not really fair, but okay, it's, you know, better to get something than nothing. I'll take the five. The interesting thing is they came back then later and exposed the people to kind of the opposite situation. And those that had made the negative decision when they were under emotional stress continued to make the same irrational decision time and time again. And if you step back and think about it, we probably all have triggers that make us react in some way. You know, someone can do something and predictably we'll get defensive, we'll get angry, we'll run away. Everyone has their own kind of reaction, but everyone has triggers that if you hit those, you'll get a predictable reaction. And they're all a little bit different. And certainly Custer had his path well laid. So the leadership lesson is really that you need to kind of understand if you have internal triggers that are counterproductive, you need to kind of reprogram yourself. And you can reprogram yourself. Probably wouldn't have worked if Custer had said, don't charge, don't charge. But maybe he would tell himself, before I charge, what are three options that I could do? Let me consider three options before I take any action. And if he'd just done that, he would have probably taken a different set of actions and been able to think about the situation rather than just react. So that's Custer. McClellan, you got to love to hate him. He's an interesting guy. So when he was put in charge, 1861, he told Lincoln, I can do it all. He was general in charge of all Union forces, and he was general in charge of the Army of the Potomac. Then things didn't go too well for him. This is at Upton Hill, which is a wonderful water park and mini golf now. We're actually working to put, we have a scout project working to put a Quaker gun there. At the time of the Civil War, after the first Battle of Manassas, the Confederates took over the site and put fortifications in, and they put Quaker guns there, and it took McClellan quite a long time to sneak up on the Quaker guns. He was quite sure that there was an overwhelming force there, and they ought to be careful, and they shouldn't go too quick. And by the time he finally got there and realized they were just painted logs, his star started to fall and Congress started to question him. And then he came out to Centerville and there were more Quaker guns and he was very reticent. And then he went to Manassas, and there were more Quaker guns, and it took him a while to sneak up on those two. He didn't learn too quick on that. And the modern research I tie to that is the Herman whole brain model. And this is a model that came out of brain imaging technology. That, you know, now they can actually show a picture of where your brain is firing. And they've been able to figure out that different quadrants of the brain have very different functions. And everyone has, you know, all four quadrants, but most people have one or two that are kind of dominant, and maybe one or two that are a little weaker. And you can plot personality characteristics. Well, McClellan was very clearly a lower left thinker. He was very organized, very sequential, planned, detailed. The other things that come in this category are controlling and fear. Because if you're controlling, then you're always a little afraid that you don't have control and don't have all the details. And he was very much there. He was a very smart guy, and he did a lot of good. Every organization should have a McClellan. He organized the army. He had great supply lines. He put training in place. He did lots of things that were very positive. But because he was so focused on every detail, and if some of the stuff I was reading of accounts at the time, I mean, he had orders on everything, including the toiletries that every soldier should carry and every possible scenario that, you know, if there's a line of trees to one side, you shouldn't have cavalry nearby because, you know, it was way too detailed to ever practically be used. But he was stuck into these details, and that made it hard for him to take initiative. If you look at it, Lee was very much up here. He was the holistic, intuitive, synthesizing, and we'll talk a little bit about him in a bit. But that helps explain McClellan. With this chapter, I look at both Lee and Grant. And there's going to be a test on this later, so I hope that you take some careful notes at this point. This is the Battle of Vicksburg. It's really the only Western battle that I put in the book because it was probably Grant's most brilliant strategic move. And as I read about it, I saw there were a lot of parallels to Lee's Chancellorsville victory in the way that they went about strategizing and doing it, and in the team that they had in place. It would take far too long to explain that. This is Chancellorsville. I'm not going to explain that either. You guys know that battle well. The similarities that Lee and Grant had, though, were that they both had strong teams in place. They had the ability to see opportunities and act quickly to gain momentum in both those battles. And they both had a great use of strategic timing. And in the book, this is one of the Gallup books, Strength-Based Leadership, the author Tom Rath talks about how to build strong teams. And basically the whole premise of these Gallup books is that strong individuals and strong organizations don't get that way by being perfect and doing everything well. There's kind of a myth that you know, you should figure out what you're not doing right and do it better. The research shows that great organizations and great individuals become that way because they figure out what they do well and they work on doing that even better. However, that creates people that that do certain things really well, but they can't do everything. So the way you build a good team is you try to get a group of people that have complementary but not the same strengths so that their complementary strengths can build off of each other's. So I looked at the two teams, the Northern team and the Southern team. And with the Northern team, you had Grant as kind of the strategist. You had Sheridan, who was his cavalry officer, and cavalry back then was really intelligence. It was riding around, figuring out the battlefield, who was in place, what was going on, and bringing that information back. And then you had Sherman, who was his dogged implementer. And at the Battle of Vicksburg, all three of them were in place at one place and functioned really, really well together in that role. And it compares really interestingly well with the Confederate team, where you have Lee the strategist, Jeb Stuart, the intelligence gatherer, the cavalry guy who was riding all over, figuring out where everyone was and what their strengths were, and Stonewall Jackson, who was the dogged implementer. And so both teams at their best had all three elements in place, and they worked together really well. If you think about the Confederate team, one of the main reasons that they didn't win Gettysburg was that by the time of Gettysburg, Stonewall Jackson was dead, Jeb Stuart was missing for the first half of the battle. So Lee was kind of, for the first time, really all alone. He didn't have his core team, and he really, when the core team was there, they were pretty much unstoppable. When the core team wasn't there, it didn't matter how much strategic brilliance he had. If he didn't have the intelligence and he didn't have the people that could go implement it well, it didn't really work. So, moving on. Chapter 5 is about the power of mission. And I open it with this quote. This is from a Union soldier, but I love the quote. This is a war to free the master as well as to free the slave. It is a war to break the shackles of ignorance, prejudice, malice, and hate that fetter the souls of you misguided brethren. It is not a war to save the Union alone. It is a war to make the Union worth saving. And if you think about it, there are lots of factors to this. But for about the first half of the war, the Confederates were really winning in most theaters. I mean, there's Union victories in there too, but overall. And in the last half of the war, the Union really took over and won a lot. Now, you can look at logistics and manpower, and all those things are absolutely legitimate to look at and real. But one of the factors was that for the first half, we're going to call it, up until the Emancipation Proclamation, the defined purpose of the Union was to preserve the Union. And that was it. Well, that's kind of, you know, a mile wide and an inch deep. Everyone could smile and nod and say, yeah, preserving the Union is great. But when people start dying, all you're really fighting for is how many stars are going to be on your flag. That doesn't seem that powerful. Meanwhile, if you look at the Confederates, when the war was happening in the South, they were the average soldier was probably fighting for home country. Certainly, the war was about slavery in the South Carolina Declaration of Secession. It's very clear that that was a key factor, but the Union didn't want to make that condition of the war early on. They were trying to negotiate something, trying to settle this quickly. And it meant that the Union soldiers didn't have a passionate reason to fight in the first half. And once they had human freedom, there was a real passionate reason to fight. So I look at Lee and at Lincoln in the Power of Mission. Sun Tzu, my hero from 500 BC, said, "You command your people in a way that gives them a higher shared purpose, and you can lead them to death or you can lead them to life." Very much in keeping. So, everyone here knows who this is? All right. Before the first battle of Manassas, what did people call him?
Tom Fool.
Tom Fool. Crazy Tom Jackson. He had all kinds of names. After that, he was called Stonewall Jackson. So in this chapter, I look at the power of progress. And I look specifically, this is very near here. Pardon?
Stone Bridge.
Stone Bridge, yep. But forget about the bridge for a moment and look at the landscape back there. I mean, it is a moonscape. It is desolate. There is nothing there. I mean, it's hard to imagine that was Fairfax County 150 years ago. I look at this quote right here, and I'm not going to read it all, but this was a little stop along the road between the Second Battle of Manassas and the Battle of Ox Hill. And you have the Stonewall Brigade, who had, you know, marched speedily fast all the way from Richmond up, fought the Second Battle of Manassas, and now they were in pursuit of the Union forces heading towards Ox Hill. And basically they had run out of all their supplies long ago. All the supplies they got in Manassas were gone. They had been living on green corn and unripe apples, and now they were looking around at this moonscape, and there wasn't even green corn and unripe apples. There was nothing. It was just barren. They were hungry. They called the Stonewall Brigade foot cavalry because they traveled so far, so fast. Stonewall Jackson did not care too much about supply lines. He had his forces carry basically just food and ammunition, and often just ammunition. And he wanted them to travel fast. So they didn't have much. If you think about, you know, we have listings now of the 100 best places to work in America with, you know, benefits and stock options, all kinds of great things. If you think about that for 1860s, the Stonewall Brigade would not rank high. You know, let's see, here's the advertisement. You know, you get to march, you know, hundreds of miles and fight lots of frontline battles and have no food and no supplies. And come on, you know, it's a great place. So, but the fact is, all of a sudden, Stonewall Jackson rides by, and his troops are lying there. They're totally exhausted. They're hungry. And they stand up and rally, and they are pumped up to see him. Well, the reason is there was a study in 2010 in the Harvard Business Review that looked at all the things that motivate people. And they found there was one that counted, and it wasn't salary and benefits and all those other things. It was progress. If you feel you're making progress in the world, you are motivated and excited and willing to go to work the next day and willing to do even more. And the other stuff is nice, but it's not the critical thing. It's progress that's the critical thing. It makes sense when you think about the Stonewall Brigade. They had nothing of that most people would consider good, except that they were probably considered the best fighting force in the entire world in the mid-19th century. They were top-notch. They won battles. They defeated armies. They had, you know, they'd just done the Shenandoah campaign where they defeated four armies and what did they march 350 miles or something in a number of a few weeks. Remarkable accomplishments. Power progress. Chapter 7 is professionalism and organizational roles at Charles Stone. So, Ball's Bluff. And I intentionally try not to... This is not a definitive work on the Battle of Ball's Bluff. Jim Morgan wrote a great book. Kim Holian's written definitive works on it. There's great stuff out there. So I try to just tell the outline of the battle and really focus on what happened afterwards. Because what happened afterwards was really the interesting part in my way of thinking. So Charles Stone's given this order, says, you know, here's the last line. There's, you know, there's Confederate forces in Leesburg. There's stuff going on in Fairfax. The orders from McClellan are, perhaps a slight demonstration on your part might have an effect to move them. Well, that sounds all well and good. What happened, though, was, as you all know, I don't have to tell you the battle, it sort of evolved, and it sort of took on a life of its own. Charles Stone spent the whole time on the Maryland side. He was trying to get across at Edwards Ferry, kind of down somewhere here, to bring reinforcements in, wasn't able to do so. And what was the big thing that happened? Well, the death of Edward Baker. Edward Baker was a star back then. Edward Baker was best friends with Abraham Lincoln. He was a senator from Oregon, and he was a household name. Everyone knew Edward Baker. And he was really the one calling the shots on the Virginia side, lining up the troops with their backs to the bluff. It was his fault that they lost the battle more than anyone else's fault. But he was famous, and he was a martyr. He'd just been killed. So you couldn't say that it was his fault. They needed a fall guy, and they sent Charles Stone to Lafayette Prison in New York Harbor for 6 months. They arrested him in the middle of the night. They took him up to Fort Lafayette, and they imprisoned him there for 6 months without any charges being leveled. He was under arrest, and he had no notion why. It was really bad. The lessons that came out of this were, one, professionalism. When he was in Lafayette Prison, he wrote letters every single day to every person he could think of, members of Congress, governors, everyone, saying, help me understand why I'm here. I don't know. No one has told me. Let me stand trial for something. I just don't know why I'm here. He was so well respected that when he was finally released, General Hooker tried to hire him as chief of staff, but wasn't allowed to do so. After the war, he really wasn't ever given any good assignment after this. After the war, Sherman actually was able to get him a job as a general in the Egyptian army. And he worked in the Egyptian army, and he actually came back. His last kind of work thing in his life was he built the foundation for the Statue of Liberty, which was in sight of Fort Lafayette, where he had been held prisoner for 6 months without any charges. There's some irony there. So great professionalism. The other lesson is organizational roles. Congress basically reached right into the ranks of the military and said, take that guy and throw him in jail and throw away the key. Well, Congress is in a governance role, not a management role. If anyone needed to be disciplined, it would have really been McClellan's role in kind of the CEO role of the Army to say, you need to be, punished or transferred or fired or what have you. And it wasn't Congress's role at all. But he didn't stand up to them, and they didn't understand their own roles. And then finally, kind of why governance boards sometimes slip into micromanagement, and it's because of lack of clear organizational roles and reacting to current or past crises. Basically, it's fear. When people are operating in fear, they're not making their best decisions. So, and there's some other great stories in there about General Stone and how he actually prevented a coup before Lincoln was inaugurated. He was a brilliant fellow, very clever, and he is underappreciated and underknown. So, Chapter 8's Decisive Leadership, Jeb Stuart. You gotta love reading about Jeb Stuart because he was such a swashbuckler. I look at his ride around McClellan's army, where he, with 1,200 Confederate soldiers, he rode 150 miles through a 100,000-person army in about 2 days, and it was remarkable. This is a quote from Captain Johnny Cook, who wrote, Stuart had decided upon his course with rapidity, good judgment, and decision, which were the real secrets of his splendid efficiency as a leader in cavalry, in which capacity, I believe, he has never been surpassed. He was now in the very heart of the enemy citadel, with enormous masses upon every side. He had driven in their advanced forces, passed within sight of the white tents of General McClellan's headquarters, burned their camps, ascertained all that he wished. How was he to return? So the way he returned was he kept going. He actually, he slept in the saddle. This guy, Captain Cook, said they'd hold on to him and ride right next to him so that he could kind of sleep and ride, because they just were moving nonstop. This is their route. Not a terribly good map. And it's a fantastic story in many ways. One of the things I love is they're almost at the end. They're almost back to Richmond, and they reach the Chickahominy River, and it is flooded and swollen, and they can't pass. And now they've been going for almost 2 days. They have the whole Union Army on their tail. They all know that they're there. They're all in hot pursuit. And they reach the banks, and his officers say, "We're done. You know, there's no chance of getting out of this." He sees the abutments of an old bridge that used to be there. He sees an old barn nearby. He sees a boat nearby, and he says, "Okay, let's build a bridge. Let's build it right now." Starts tearing down the boards from the barn, uses the boat as a float in the middle. He jumps right in there, starts humming a song and working right along with his guys while they build this bridge. They don't know whether the enemy is going to be on them in 2 minutes, in 5 minutes, in an hour. They just don't know how much time they have. He shows fantastic leadership there, because if he had shown despair, they would have been lost. There was no other way to get across. They wind up building the bridge because they're all highly focused now on the task. They get across. They tear down the bridge. They ride away. Right as they're riding out of sight, the Union forces pull up. It's just a great story. And the research that I draw from is, it's actually a Japanese university 2008 study where they looked at decisive leadership, decisive decision-making, and its role on organizations. And basically what happens, it makes sense, when the leadership in an organization is willing to make change, is willing to change direction based on new information, all of a sudden everyone in the organization starts gathering information and feeding it out, and because they know it's going to be used. It's useful. Let's start learning. When an organization doesn't show any interest in change, they say, We looked at that option 20 years ago. That can't be done. Forget about it. We're doing what we always do. We're not changing. All of a sudden, everyone shuts down. There's no point in bringing new information in, because it's clear that there's not going to be any change in decision. So it has an effect, permeates the entire organization, as to whether you're a learning organization and a changing organization, or a static one that isn't paying any attention to the outside world. Phil Sheridan, The Power of Personality. There he is. This is the Battle of Cedar Creek. Sorry. Drew a blank there. There he is there. Now, if you all know the Battle of Cedar Creek, this happened in October of 1864, actually just a couple of weeks before the election. Of 1864, when McClellan was running against Lincoln. And it's widely credited with winning Lincoln a second term in office, because the Union wasn't doing particularly well at the time. There was a lot of thought that maybe we need to elect McClellan and kind of sue for peace. And Sheridan won this battle. They were in complete rout. They had been attacked in the early dawn hours. The Union had been attacked in early dawn hours and driven miles away from their camp. And Sheridan had been in Washington for some meetings. And I don't know why, but he cut those meetings short and rushed back. I don't know why he did that. But he hurried back and made it in there. And as he came into Winchester, he could hear shots in the distance. And he started riding towards the base camp he had left at Cedar Creek, And he starts seeing soldiers coming back in despair, saying all's lost. And at first he thinks, well, maybe I should just gather everyone up and form a new line and, you know, we can fight a battle tomorrow. And as he starts sending out his officers in different directions, he comes up with a new idea. And that is to turn around right at that moment and go back and win. And he said, I already knew that even in ordinary conditions, the mind of enthusiasm is a potent element with soldiers. But what I saw that day convinced me that if it can be taken from a state of despondency, its power is almost irresistible. So he rode up and down the lines. First he formed the lines, rode up and down the lines, waved his hat, yelled at them, was very energetic, and they got pumped up. They turned around, and they won the day, which is remarkable. They didn't have any cannons. They didn't have any supplies. They'd all been overrun. And by the end of the day, they had all their stuff back. They were back in their camp, and they basically, that was the end of the of fighting in the Shenandoah of any significance, because they had won. So the MIT did a study where they were looking at nonverbal communication, and they found that people who are energetic and positive and had more face-to-face time with those who they were dealing with had a higher degree of success. And in all the accounts of Sheridan, he is a super energetic guy. Lincoln liked him, Grant liked him, and he had a tremendous effect on all those that he was leading because he had charisma. What the MIT study sort of decoded was, what is charisma? And if you think about it, it makes some sense that we communicate in lots of ways that are not verbal, and we don't even know it or think about it very much. But, you know, if you think evolutionary terms, before there was, great language development, we were probably still communicating in small groups, and we were communicating in nonverbal ways. And we have that kind of hardwired in us. So they could measure inflection and figure out when people are focused on an objective and very energized by it, their words come out differently. Their inflection comes out differently. And it's kind of universal. It doesn't matter what language or anything. So it's pretty interesting. And certainly Sheridan had that charisma. Chapter 10 is John Gibbon. How many people know John Gibbon? All right, I've got a fantastic group here. So John Gibbon led the Black Hat Brigade, which was later known as the Iron Brigade, and arguably the toughest Union infantry group out there. I look at a number of battles, one being Browner's Farm, not too far from here in Manassas. But I really look at Antietam, and there's Gibbon right there. And I look at about a 20-minute period of time in the Battle of Antietam where a colonel is shot down, a major takes on the role of a colonel, their group moves forward, and they come upon Gibbon himself. And Gibbon, who was a artillery officer before the war, has dismounted from his horse, and the artillery is under such heavy fire they can't man it. And he's out there single-handedly loading, aiming, and firing one of the cannons because they have to hold the line. So in the course of about 20 minutes, you have a major taking on the role of a colonel and a general taking on the role of maybe three or four, privates and sergeants. And the interesting thing about that is the Iron Brigade spent the first year that they were in the war, right here in Northern Virginia. They were building forts and training. And they built, there were a whole string of forts around the city of Washington. They worked on lots of them. They spent time at Upton Hill as well. They like the mini golf, I hear. You guys laugh. Come on. Mini golf was huge back then. Why do you think, you know, Upton Hill was such a popular fort? But I ask and try to answer the age-old question of, is it experience or is it training that matters? You guys have an answer to that?
Yes.
Yes is the answer. First battle they come up with is at Browner's Farm. They're head-to-head with the Stonewall Brigade. We've already talked about them. The toughest, battle-hardened veterans the Confederates had, and the Iron Brigade, weren't known that as at that time, had never shot their guns in battle before. They fought to a standstill. You look at Antietam, huge losses. But the interesting thing was they continued to function really well as a group, even though people were dropping right and left. And there's Antietam. What I looked at was a study that came out in the Journal of Organizational Sciences that looked at urban hospitals and training. And what they found, and they were looking at the effect of attrition when people leave. What they found was the hospitals that had lots of cross-training and groups with people that from different functions that were working together did really well when someone left because everyone knew everyone's job and they could just step right in and make it happen seamlessly. When the organization was kind of siloed and people didn't know the other people's jobs because they were very focused on their own, someone leaves, you don't even know what the problem is, but all of a sudden things start falling apart. You can look at that very clearly with the Iron Brigade, and what made them such a good brigade was the training that John Gibbon brought to them and really drilled them much harder than almost any other group out there and took them from raw recruits from Illinois and Wisconsin and made them into one of the most effective fighting forces in the whole Civil War. Next to the last chapter, and the last chapters I'm not going to go into. It's more just focused on, you know, what's your best leadership style. But this is the last kind of Civil War example. I look at Mosby again. One chapter wasn't enough. There's the guy. I look at December 6th, 1864. Think about that date for a minute. It is the end of 1864. The whole end of the war is just a few months away. He rides down to the outskirts of Richmond, Petersburg area, and they're stuck in trench warfare. Lee's headquarters and Grant's headquarters are less than a mile apart, and the Confederates are in rags. They have very little food rations. They're pretty demoralized. He rides up. He's just bought a brand new uniform. It's beautiful. Red cape. You know, he used to work for Jeb Stuart, so he knew how to dress for success. So he comes down there. He has a brand new set of knee-high cavalry boots that are, you know, shined and beautiful. He has this brand new horse that he's riding, which is, you know, he only rode the best of the best horses. Probably all the other horses are, you know, starving and have their ribs showing. And he pulls up on this thoroughbred with this brand new uniform, hat with ostrich feather. I mean, he's a vision from some other time. You know, that's the way Confederate officers dressed in, you know, 1861 and 2. This is 1864 and times are tough. He jumps off there. Goes has a meeting with Lee, and the reason he's having the meeting is he needs to expand his operation because he's doing really well and he wants orders that will make him a full colonel and allow him to have a bigger operation. You got to ask yourself, well, what's going on there? You know, he's not fighting the same war that everyone else is. Well, what's happening is innovation. He is succeeding because he is not fighting at all the same war that everyone else is. And his areas of innovation are Partisan Ranger Act. A lot of groups were formed under the Partisan Ranger Act. neither side really, and the Union had some too, neither side liked it. The regular army didn't want it. Jeb Stuart tried to talk Mosby out of this. He said, oh, call them Mosby's regulars, you know, and be regular cavalry. And he said, no, I want to be under this Partisan Ranger Act because it's basically the laws of a privateer. Once you have an action, anything that's of military value, you turn into the quartermaster, and everything else, you divide up the booty. So basically, they were self-paid and self-armed. So they had a fantastic, they had all the best weapons because they would take them from the Union, and they'd only keep the best stuff. They had no base of operation. Well, that was just counter to any thinking. So the Union would send out parties to try to find them, and they could round up one or two of them, but they could never find them. And weapons and training. At that period of time, whether you were cavalry or Union, there was a whole lot of lining up and moving in formation and patterns because it was all kind of based on Napoleonic tactics that all the good officers learned at West Point. Well, he didn't go to West Point. He didn't go to any military school. He was a lawyer and classical studies, and he, if you read his memoirs, he talks a lot about, you know, Frederick the Great and Alexander the Great, and he's studying these folks. He's not looking at Napoleon. He's looking way back and figuring out what worked well. And his guys couldn't line up if they had to. There's a great quote from one of his men in one of their memoirs that said if they had to line up, they just couldn't do it. But what they could do is shoot and ride. And their training, they would go galloping along and put three shots from their revolver into the trunk of a tree. The Union weren't doing that. And then they were carrying multiple revolvers. And it was a totally different way of fighting. So I look at this book called Blue Ocean Strategy. It's really a fantastic book on innovation. But the fundamental formula for blue ocean strategy. And the idea of blue ocean is red ocean is red with the blood of competition. Blue ocean is you are doing something so totally different that you have no competition. Competition is irrelevant. You are out there creating your own space, your own market, and there's a whole series of examples in blue ocean strategy. They don't mention Mosby, but I do. And the fundamental thing is you figure out ways to reduce your cost of operation and at the same time increase the value of it. And so you come up with a value innovation. You think about it, base of operations, supply lines, all those things, that's the cost of operation. He didn't have that. He didn't even need a payroll. I mean, you know, they got paid every once in a while, but they were self-paid. So their cost of operation was nothing. They were succeeding kind of off the grid. And value, well, they were fighting in a totally different revolutionary way that the Union thought was just, quite frankly, unfair. You know, they just weren't playing by the rules. And exactly right, they weren't playing by the rules. They were riding in fast and using their revolvers and fighting in a method that was totally different from the way everyone was being trained to fight. So they were creating this value innovation. So The closing chapter is about leadership styles, kind of drawing from all the chapters, but that's the book in much more than a nutshell, probably much more than you wanted to know. But anyway, I've got copies back there. They're $15, but I'm happy to, oh, the other thing is I have copies of a DVD from this new documentary that we just put out with Roger Mudd, where we looked at the Civil War history through regional parks, and Mark was at the premiere. It's playing on Channel 16, which is the Fairfax government channel right now. It will only be playing for probably the next 30 years. So you better get a DVD and so that you don't miss it. But I'm happy to answer any questions. Yes?
I think it was a History Channel had a piece using the art of war and comparing it to why Lee lost Gettysburg. Because he broke all the rules.
Probably so. Yep. Now, I intentionally didn't cover Gettysburg just because there's so much written about it. I was, quite frankly, trying to find stories that maybe not everyone else has heard. But, I mean, the Art of War is, it's fantastic stuff. The first time I read it, I thought this is kind of strange, crazy poetry kind of thing. And then I read it again, I thought, wow, this is pretty good. And I read it a third time, I thought, it's brilliant. Read a fourth time, best thing I've ever read. So I encourage you guys to dig that up and read it. Yes, ma'am.
Anything that explains why they all thought Napoleon was such a successful
he was
beaten twice.
He was.
By the British.
I mean, he took over most of Europe, so he wasn't entirely a failure. So anyway. But I don't know. But he was certainly the dominant model. Tom?
Speaking of your Blue Ocean cover there, how about Admiral Farragut?
I did not. I mean, there's so many folks that you could do this with. Part of my goal is I want to promote local history and tourism of this area. So I really tried to focus most of my stories. All other than Vicksburg, everything else happened within not more than 100 miles of here, and most of it within 50 miles of here. So that was one of the reasons. So.
The statue's right downtown.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, if you go by statues, I could go everywhere.
So is Grant
Sheridan. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Do you know if they studied Sun Tzu at West Point during the education of these generals?
I'm pretty sure they did not. I think the Sun Tzu was not really translated into English until much later, and I see heads nodding. You might know better.
Yeah, we studied it at the Army War College when I attended there in 1989, and it was a fairly new innovation.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was not translated into English in the 19th century. So it's sometime in the 20th century that it was discovered by the West. Yes?
Did you find a particular aha moment as you were preparing?
You know, it was that first quote from Mosby in the first chapter about victory. You know, they thought victory was chained to my standard. That was kind of I wasn't planning on writing a book, and that got me. I was working on a brochure for Aldi Mill, and Mosby had an action at Aldi Mill, and all I had was this one little quote, which was, when they pulled them from the bins, there was nothing blue about them. Talking about when Union soldiers had jumped into the flour bins, and I thought, well, that's pretty darn humorous. Let me see what I could find. I just Googled that. It took me to Google Books, and it took me to Mosby's memoirs. I read that incident. It was a fantastic one, and I liked it so much I just kept reading. And that was really my introduction to reading primary sources, and my introduction to reading what Mosby himself wrote, and just got me hooked. So.
Now that you mentioned the British guy from the Crimean War that was running
for
Moses, Hoskins was his name, and he's buried at Greenwich Presbyterian Church off of Ben Hill Road. And his family has a very nice stone there for him. And if you ever want to visit, I don't know if you've ever seen that before.
I have not. You know, the other interesting person that rode with Mosby was Baron von Massow. I'm probably not pronouncing it right, but he was the illegitimate son of the King of Prussia, and that's kind of fun to say, the illegitimate son of the King of Prussia. But he was a baron. He was fabulously wealthy. He was a senior German commander at the beginning of World War I, and sort of brought some of Mosby's stuff with him. The interesting thing is when he died without any heirs, and he left his fortune to the surviving members of Mosby's Rangers. And I've read the newspaper articles from about 1900 or 19, maybe even 19, no, it must have been like 1916. And, you know, his fortune at the time was, I don't know, a couple million dollars, which, you know, back then was a lot of money, a whole lot of money. So I never was able to find, like, the follow-up to how that worked out. But if you were a surviving Mosby Ranger, I bet a lot of folks raised their hand and said, yeah, I rode with him one day. Yes, sir.
Sort of a question. It seems like you talked about the sort of flash, you know, like Stewart, Jackson, and Mosby having all this, you know, great, charming flair of leadership. Guys will follow them to hell, that sort of thing. And the Union had Custer, and it had Custer. The overall long-term arching solution was the Union Army won the war. And I don't know if there's something about the overall sort of leadership there about, I don't know, the ability to take sacrifice and learn and move on. And
you know, one of the interesting outcomes of the Charles Stone issue was Charles Stone took initiative in one of the first battles of the war. And it didn't go well, and he was thrown in jail, and his career was ruined afterwards. That had a chilling effect on the whole Union officer corps and their willingness to take risks after that. I mean, it took a long time. If you know, put yourself in that mind, and you think, are you going to stay at base, or are you going to go out and do something crazy that might wind you in jail? And maybe, you know, maybe you should think about that and stay in base another day or two. I think that's one of the reasons it took the Union a long time. I think they didn't have a great mission to begin with, and they had sort of really done damage to their own officer corps by setting such a terrible example so early on. You know, if they had taken Stone and said, well, you didn't win, but gosh, you fought a good fight and you took initiative, and let's host a party for you. It might have sent a different signal. So, yes, sir.
Just a comment. When you were talking about Gibbon,
yeah,
cross training, the modern equivalent of the Navy SEALs and the Special Forces, they're all cross trained. One drop, somebody else can.
Yep. Absolutely.
Thank you
very much. Thanks.
Fantastic job.
Thank you so much.